Hello, everybody. I'm Danny Boom Boom McCarthy.
Johnny, get your gun, get your gun, get your gun. Take it on the run, on the run, on the run. Hear them calling you and me, every son of liberty. Hurry right away, no delay, go today. Make your daddy glad to have had such a lad. Tell your sweetheart not to pine, to be proud her boy's in line. Over there, over there, send the word over there, that the Yanks are coming, the Yanks are coming, the drums rum coming everywhere. So prepare, say a prayer, send the word to beware. We'll be over, we're coming over, and we won't come back till it's over, over there, over there, over there. Send the word over there, that the Yanks are coming, the Yanks are
Good day, everybody, and welcome to the Story of Nowhere podcast. I really hope you've enjoyed the Brief History of Critical Thinking series. It took quite a while to put it all together, but I think it was well worth the effort. If you haven't heard it yet, or don't even know what I'm talking about, go to storyofnowhere.com, or find the Story of Nowhere podcast on your favorite podcast app, and start from the beginning. There's a whole series of episodes just waiting for you there, all about the history and development of logic, reason, and critical thinking. Which, yes, might all be the same thing. I just wanted to squeeze in a bunch of words there to sound important. But seriously, if that sounds interesting or compelling to you, you should probably check it out. And if it doesn't sound that interesting or compelling, then, well, I don't know. Just keep listening to this one, I guess. This episode, however, is not part of any series, though it is definitely related to the critical thinking shows. But before I get into that, some of you might be wondering about current events. Specifically, what I think about current events. I mean, I guess I picked one hell of a time to start a podcast, huh? We're living in a wild time, a time which certainly has a lot to bear on the idea of utopian world-building. So yeah, I think that current events are going to be a pretty important element of this show moving forward, because it's just so important to monitor what goes on in more or less real time if we hope to move the dial at all away from tyranny and toward personal freedom. But mere coverage of the news won't do the job. Not if we're serious about opposing utopianism. Sorry. I'm sorry to tell you that just chasing headlines and keeping up with what's going on right now will not provide an adequate picture of our situation. Certainly there will have to be some of that, but I think that far greater quality of understanding can be delivered by offering a historical and philosophical curriculum, for lack of a better, as opposed to just being another guy regurgitating the goddamn deluge of contradictory and controversial and calumnious quantities of the news. Your cup already runneth over with good guys and gals doing exactly that. Here on the Story of Nowhere, we're about context. Context that will help you make better sense of the news on your own without me sneakily trying to tell you what to think. So rather than tell you about some bullshit that's circulating right now, today I'm going to provide you with some context which will hopefully help you in making sense of this world we live in. Instead of wading into the controversial, I'm going to show you the totally historically uncontrovertible. Maybe, just maybe, you'll find this bit of history applicable to your current events. No controversy, no dispute. This episode is entitled The Constitution of the Invisible Government. Year of Our Lord 1920, 100 years ago. The world was finally calming down after the horrific calamity that had rocked it for half a decade. Half of the previous year, 1919, saw heads of state convened in the historic home of the French ancient regime, assembled to ensure that the so-called Great War was indeed the war to end all wars. Their everlasting peace didn't even make it 20 years. Representing America was the president himself, Woodrow Wilson. With him and his entourage was a young agent of the Committee on Public Information, or CPI, which Wilson himself had created 2 years prior. Though now the mission was peace, the CPI and its young agent had spent those last 2 years drumming up American support for the war at the behest of the president. Prior to American entry into World War I, the general attitude towards the war was one of disinterested neutrality and perhaps even contempt. The typical American had no reason to feel one way or another about the latest in a centuries-long string of European conflicts. She certainly had no reason to let one of her sons go fight and die in such a conflict. Yet powerful financial and political interests in the United States did want to go to war. Well, they didn't want to go to war, of course, not at all. I should say they wanted other people to go to war. Thus, just 8 days after the United States government declared itself an official participant in the war, President Wilson, who was himself a staunch believer that America should maintain an international presence in order to police the world, created the Committee on Public Information. The committee was tasked with selling the American people on the war. It was to propagate the faith of military intervention. The CPI made quick and abundant use of all of the available media technologies of the day. It distributed posters, pamphlets, and magazines, ran campaigns in schools and churches, and utilized newspapers, radio, and even moving pictures. They even expanded beyond the U.S. The CPI ran international campaigns, mostly in Central and South America, to promote the idea that the United States was the rightful leader of the free world. Committee member and Secretary of War during World War I, Newton Baker, said the role of the CPI was, quote, mobilizing the mind of the world, unquote. It was, he continued, a, quote, fight for the minds of men and for the conquest of their convictions, unquote. According to the subtitle of a book written by the head of the committee, George Creel, the CPI, quote, carried the gospel of Americanism to every corner of the globe, unquote. Just like Il Congregatio de Propaganda Fide, the organization established by Pope Gregory XV in 1622, from which our word propaganda derives, the purpose of the Committee on Public Information was to propagate a faith. But in 1919, the war was over, and a 28-year-old CPI agent was with Woodrow Wilson at the Paris Peace Talks. He'd been chosen to work under Creel at a time when mass communications technology, the playground of modern propaganda, was just beginning to trickle down to the general public. Even in his early 20s, he had made quite a name for himself as an excellent corporate propagandist. He was profoundly interested in the inner workings of the human mind, an interest he shared with his favorite uncle, the Viennese psychoanalyst Sigmund Freud. His coming to grips with the hidden, emotional, and even primal motivations behind human behavior, coupled with his observations of the CPI's successes with propaganda during the war, led him to conclude, upon returning from Europe in 1919, quote, there was one basic lesson I learned in the CPI, that efforts comparable to those applied by the CPI to affect the attitudes of the enemy, of neutrals, and people of this country, could be applied with equal facility to peacetime pursuits. In other words, what could be done for a nation at war could be done for organizations and people in a nation at peace. Unquote. It was Edward Louis Bernays who made this remark. Edward Louis Bernays, who traveled to Europe with the president before the age of 30. Edward Louis Bernays, who had become one of the most prolific and influential propagandists of the 20th century. Bernays made a living putting his uncle Sigmund's theories of unconscious motivations to the test, and in doing so, he made a lot of people a lot of money. He was eventually recognized as the father of the field of public relations, although this recognition may have been more a result of tactful self-promotion than an actual reflection of reality. He was by no means the first public relations man. It's hard to say who actually was the first. Ivy Ledbetter Lee, not to be confused with Ivy Bedwetter Lee. He had been working in the field for something like a decade before Bernays got started. But throughout his life, Edward Bernays touted himself as the prime pioneer in the public relations world, and this persistence ultimately paid off. If you ask someone who the father of public relations is, you'll get one of two answers. Huh? Or Edward Bernays. But regardless of who came first, the reality remains that public relations was only a euphemism for propaganda, since that word had become taboo after the First World War. Make no mistake, PR is propaganda. 9 years after his trip with Wilson to observe international politics in action, Bernays wrote an aptly titled book called Propaganda, which was supposed to be one part manual, one part advertisement for his newly formed field of public relations, intended to be read by his potential clientele. In today's episode, we'll be looking at this short little book. In it, Bernays frankly lays out why he thinks propaganda is necessary in our kind of society. He lays out how it's done, and what it's capable of if used correctly. Again, this book was written for his corporate and government clientele. It wasn't really intended for the likes of you and I. And it's for that reason that everybody should own a copy of this book, and everybody should read it. It's only about 120 pages long, but it's worth its weight in gold a couple of times over. You really can't have an accurate picture of how powerful people organize society and interact with the public until you've read Bernays. He envisioned a society, a pragmatic, scientific utopia, in which a shady class of psychological experts make every decision, large or small, for all people, all the time. All from behind the scenes. And if you think I'm making this up or maybe mischaracterizing Bernays, let me read to you from the very first and second pages of the book. Quote, "The conscious and intelligent manipulation of the organized habits and opinions of the masses is an important element in democratic society. Those who manipulate this unseen mechanism of society constitute an invisible government, which is the true ruling power of our country. We are governed, our minds are molded, our tastes formed, our ideas suggested, largely by men we have never heard of. This is a logical result of the way in which our democratic society is organized. Vast numbers of human beings must cooperate in this manner if they are to live together as a smoothly functioning society. Our invisible governors are, in many cases, unaware of the identity of their fellow members in the inner cabinet. They govern us by their qualities of natural leadership, their ability to supply needed ideas, and by their key position in the social structure. Whatever attitude one chooses to take toward this condition, it remains a fact that in almost every act of our daily lives, whether in the sphere of politics or business, in our social conduct or our ethical thinking, we are dominated by the relatively small number of persons, a trifling fraction of our 120 million, who understand the mental processes and social patterns of the masses. It is they who pull the wires which control the public mind, who harness old social forces and contrive new ways to bind and guide the world." Unquote. That's the first thing he says. So no, I'm not mischaracterizing. Propaganda is the language of his invisible governors, or you might say, the language of utopianism. So naturally, it's quite apropos to the study of utopianism in general. There are obviously plenty of books written on the subject of propaganda, and some of these I'll definitely reference here on this show. But, because this is the first show I'm doing on the subject, I really want to focus primarily on Bernays' seminal book. It's written so frankly, not as a critique of propaganda, but, again, as a manual or even advertisement for propaganda. What commentator Mark Crispin Miller calls propaganda propaganda in the introduction he wrote for the 2004 reprinting of the book. So before we get started, I just want to give you a short list of some of Bernays' jobs over the years. While working for American Tobacco Company in 1929, he marketed cigarettes to women's rights activists as torches of freedom, breaking a long-held taboo against ladies smoking. It was like the original woke commercial, only live. People get upset over this one, but I don't know. Smoking is cool, so. While working for Beechnut Packing Company, he got a bunch of doctors to say that a hearty breakfast of bacon and eggs is healthy in order to sell more of their packaged product. I like this one. He came up with the idea of hosting soap carving contests to sell Procter & Gamble's Ivory Soap, a tradition which apparently lasted into the 1960s. Frankly, I'm not really sure how much I believe Bernays' claims of how successful this one was. Sounds pretty dopey to me, but whatever. While working for American Tobacco, this time in 1934, he actually put on a lavish, green-themed ball called the Green Ball to convince people who care about fashion and style and whatnot that the color green was super in. All this so the company wouldn't have to change the green packaging of Lucky Strikes. The effectiveness of this one is debatable, though I must admit that even the mere possibility that this would actually work seriously damages my opinion of Americans. He claims in his autobiography to have facilitated the appointment of Henry A. Wallace to the position of Secretary of Agriculture in the Franklin Roosevelt administration by hosting a gathering of big-time bankers and financiers at the famous Bankers Club at 120 Broadway in Lower Manhattan. If you're interested in the minutiae of shady international power and have a pen handy, 120 Broadway might be something you want to write down. Probably won't be coming up in this episode, but you can be sure it'll come up in the future. Anyway, this claim can't really be confirmed with any certainty, though Wallace is listed as a client of Bernays's in the description of his personal archives, the link of which I will put in the show notes. Okay, one more. This is a good one. In 1954, while working for the United Fruit Company, which is now Chiquita, Bernays ran a smear campaign on the newly elected president of Guatemala, who the company feared might give them the boot. The Guatemalan president was branded a dangerous communist, and the CIA did what it does best. It went in and overthrew him, and installed a new president who was cozy with corporate America. All the while, Bernays was in charge of news of these events to the International Wire Services. After the coup succeeded, Bernays helped tailor the positive image of the new Guatemalan leader and even advised him on making public appearances. This one's a little different from selling bacon in the color green. Hopefully all that gives you an idea of what this guy did. Now let's dig into what he said. The opening paragraphs of his book, which I read you just a minute ago, really summarize the whole philosophy of propaganda. I mean, public relations. Right at the outset, he introduces the idea itself and contends that propaganda was and would increasingly become the most important element in the development of the society of the future. He assures his readers that the inner workings of the common man's mind is understood by experts, and that, luckily for government and business, these experts will happily sell that understanding to whoever can pay for it. Every decision, he says, that an individual makes, whether large or small, is actually made for him or her by these experts. Just in the first few pages of the book, Bernays makes it clear that he believes in the total malleability of the mass mind. My thoughts are not truly mine, and your thoughts are not truly yours. Our thoughts and opinions and attitudes have all been shaped in advance, packaged and sold to us by a cabal of secret psychological rulers. Furthermore, he says that without these invisible governors, again, his words, our society would cease to function. The propagandist stands at the junction of chaos and order, and directs the slobbering and farting masses from the one road to the other. This is how Bernays sets the stage for his little manual. Pretty dramatic, huh? But before you go thinking that this proves some gigantic conspiracy, and believe me, I can understand how you might get that impression, he does add that the invisible governors don't all know each other. They don't make up some monolithic organization. Instead, the invisible government is a loose collection of self-interested parties whose only commonality with each other is their ability to shape public opinion. This is actually a really important point for a couple of reasons. First, on the surface level, it reveals that the powers that be aren't actually one thing. That in American society, there are numerous and often competing propaganda campaigns vying for our attention at all times. Second, on a deeper level, Bernays' revelation speaks to the ubiquity of propaganda. Whether you're a Democrat or a Republican or a communist or a Nazi, or you're just looking to buy some soap, propaganda is playing with your head. In other words, no matter how much Bill Maher and Bill O'Reilly hate each other, both are brought together in a way by virtue of the fact that both are essentially propagandists. This is indicative of a related and important point about the corporate and political world in general. Differently interested parties may find themselves organically aligning with one another when their interests converge. This fact is often obscured by so-called conspiracy theorists who want all sorts of distinct organizations to secretly be one organization. Then this cartoonish picture of what's really going on prevents so-called normies who think they're smarter than all of that from ever even considering that there may actually be some funny business going on behind the scenes. And speaking of Bill Maher, here's what the great George Carlin said on exactly this subject back in the 90s on Maher's old show.
California, not as a result of a conspiracy, but
you
because...
You don't need a formal conspiracy.
Right.
When interests converge, these people went to the same universities and fraternities. They're on the same boards of directors. They're in the same country clubs. They have like interests. They don't need to call a meeting. They know what's good for them. And they're getting it. And there used to be seven oil companies. There are now three. It will soon be two. The things that matter in this country have been reduced in choice. There are two political parties. There are a handful of insurance companies. There are about six or seven information, but if you want a bagel, there are 23 flavors because you have the illusion. You have the illusion of choice.
Right.
You don't get the real important choice. There's no freedom of choice.
That's a great point. Yeah.
This organic alignment was and is central to Bernaysian propaganda. While in the olden days an advertisement would be purely about function, buy this blanket, it is warm. Buy this chair, it is sturdy. Bernays sought to associate a product with certain emotions and bring as many secondarily interested parties into the fold as possible. So let's take the example of the green ball, when Bernays marketed the color green to benefit his client, American Tobacco Company. See, according to his plan, the ball wouldn't just benefit American Tobacco. It also benefited the Onondaga Silk Company, who Bernays tipped off to start pumping out green dresses. It benefited Vogue magazine, who could report endlessly on the new fad. And it benefited the Waldorf Astoria, who Bernays had chosen to host the event. Or we might take Bernays's other adventure with American Tobacco, when he sold cigarettes as torches of freedom. He revealed, in a manner of speaking, a common interest shared by both the women's movement and the cigarette company. The women wanted to take down the symbols of male supremacy, of which the taboo against women smoking was one, and the company, of course, didn't mind doubling its market. The role of a propagandist like Bernays is to exploit these potential alignments of interest that might otherwise go unnoticed. This would then mean a multi-fronted assault on the public, with a variety of seemingly independent parties all promoting the same thing. As Bernays remarks in his autobiography, quote, emphasis by repetition gains acceptance for an idea, particularly if the repetition comes from different sources. Unquote. A similar sort of thing applies to regular people as well. Toward the end of Chapter 1 of Propaganda, he devotes 3 pages to listing different groups and associations throughout the country, including the Royal Order of the Sphinx, the National Circus Fans Association of America, the Texas Folklore Association, the Insecticide and Disinfectant Association, the National Pickle Packers Association, and of course, the National Knitted Outerwear Association. The point of this is to show that there are many groups that people belong to, and most people belong to more than one group. Thus, there's an intersectionality of influence running through a great many seemingly separate walks of life. For an example, he posits John Jones, who, quote, besides being a Rotarian, is member of a church, a fraternal order, of a political party, of a charitable organization, of a professional association, of a local chamber of commerce, of a league for or against prohibition, or of a society for or against lowering the tariff, or of a golf club. The opinions which he receives as a Rotarian he will tend to disseminate in the other groups in which he may have influence. Unquote. By simply being involved in society, we are each, to varying degrees, caught in a web of influence. Whether we are the influential ones or the ones being influenced makes no difference. In fact, both are probably true simultaneously. He continues, quote, "This invisible, intertwining structure of groupings and associations is the mechanism by which democracy has organized its group mind and simplified its mass thinking. To deplore the existence of such a mechanism is to ask for a society such as never was and never will be. To admit that it exists, but expect that it shall not be used, is unreasonable." Unquote. This means that, while tastes and opinions are formed by professional propagandists, the propaganda itself is largely disseminated by unsuspecting members of the public as they interact with their various group affiliations. While a man like Edward Bernays makes a ton of money, he's got thousands, maybe even millions of people distributing his product for him. And they're indirectly paying him for the privilege. But let's get back to the big organizations and their role in shaping modern society, as that is what Bernays really focuses on in the beginning of the book. He makes it clear that just as certain firms might align on certain issues or products or whatnot, all organizations, public or private, must be aligned by their common need for and use of propaganda. He insists that total propaganda is, in fact, necessary to the sort of society America was becoming in the 1920s, a high-tech, corporate, internationally concerned society. He says that with all of the complexities of politics and economics, the average person couldn't possibly do the work necessary to make an informed, ideally democratic decision. I think he's absolutely right about this, and that's one of the reasons why I think democracy is dumb, at least on such a large scale. But rather than saying, decentralize, decentralize, Bernays instead embraces the progress that defined the era and says, you can have your democracy, but it's not going to be what you think it is. Starting on the second page of propaganda, he says, quote, "In theory, every citizen makes up his mind on public questions and matters of private conduct. In practice, if all men had to study for themselves the abstruse economic, political, and ethical data involved in every question, they would find it impossible to come to a conclusion about anything. We have voluntarily agreed to let an invisible government sift the data and high-spot the outstanding issues, so that our field of choice shall be narrowed to practical proportions. From our leaders and the media they use to reach the public, we accept the evidence and the demarcation of issues bearing upon public questions. From some ethical teacher, be it a minister, a favorite essayist, or merely prevailing opinion, we accept a standardized code of social conduct to which we conform most of the time." Unquote. Skipping down a bit, now on to page 3, he says, quote, "Society consents to have its choice narrowed to ideas and objects brought to its attention through propaganda of all kinds. There's consequently a vast and continuous effort going on to capture our minds in the interest of some policy or commodity or idea. It might be better to have, instead of propaganda and special pleading, committees of wise men who would choose our rulers, dictate our conduct, private and public, and decide upon the best types of clothes for us to wear and the best kinds of food for us to eat. But we have chosen the opposite method, that of open competition. We must find a way to make free competition function with reasonable smoothness. To achieve this, society has consented to permit free competition to be organized by leadership and propaganda." Unquote. Bernays gives us two choices: total, overt, top-down dictatorship, or total, covert, top-down dictatorship. I'm sorry to put it so cynically, but I just don't know what else to call the system he's describing. He's already established that he believes that, quote, "In almost every act of our daily lives, whether in the sphere of politics or business, in our social conduct or our ethical thinking, we are dominated by the relatively small number of persons who understand the mental processes and social patterns of the masses," unquote. He has already established that this, quote, "relatively small number of persons," unquote, who dominate us, which he calls the invisible government, is composed of, quote, "men we have never heard of," unquote. He can call this arrangement democracy all he wants, but, well, what would you call it? And let's not let him get away with that bit about how society has consented to this arrangement. Again, he says, quote, "We have voluntarily agreed to let invisible government sift the data and high-spot the outstanding issues so that our field of choice shall be narrowed to practical proportions," unquote. And, quote, "Society consents to have its choice narrowed to ideas and objects brought to its attention through propaganda of all kinds," unquote. Now, we don't even have to get into all that consent of the governed business to point out what's wrong with this. His logic is internally incoherent here. He just spent the first page and a half of his book telling us, or rather his potential clients, that the public has no idea that propagandists are working behind the scenes to shape their opinions. And now on the second and third pages, he's saying that the same public, which doesn't know the invisible government exists, has consented to the activities of the invisible government. I mean, come on. So while that line of thinking just doesn't go anywhere, we can actually make something of his ideas about democracy. Toward the beginning of chapter 2, he says, quote, "The minority has discovered a powerful help in influencing majorities. It has been found possible so to mold the mind of the masses that they will throw their newly gained strength in the desired direction. In the present structure of society, this practice is inevitable. Whatever of social importance is done today, whether in politics, finance, manufacture, agriculture, charity, education, or other fields, must be done with the help of propaganda. Propaganda is the executive arm of the invisible government," unquote. Allow me, if you will, to take this along with the other statements he's made about democracy so far, and very simply lay out what I think Bernays' theory of democracy looks like. But first, let me remind you that this book is freely available online. Freely, as in, it costs you no money to read it. So you should probably go and do that, and see for yourself if you agree with my analysis, or if you think I'm full of shit. That said, I shall now proceed with no apologies. This is Bernays' theory of democracy, presented as a simple syllogism. Democracy is the rule of the majority. The majority is ruled by propagandists. Therefore, democracy is the rule of propagandists. If you've listened to episode 2 of this show, then you should know that this is, in fact, a valid syllogism. The conclusion necessarily follows from the premises. But is it a sound syllogism? Are the premises true? It's certainly true that Bernays believed they were, at least he writes as if he believed they were. If you're playing along at home, the first four paragraphs of chapter 2 are what you're going to want to read. He starts by defining the democratic ideal. The masses promise to become king, he says. And then he explains that minorities of propagandists, in reality, are the ones who really guide the thoughts of the masses who were supposed to become their own king. Of course, how this is done is the subject of the book itself. And already in chapter 1, he's expressed this sentiment over and over, as we've seen. Propagandists write the script. We just act. But again, the question is it true? Is his theory of democracy sound? We can't really deny the first premise, that democracy is majority rule. I mean, that's kind of the definition of democracy. So I think we got to say that premise 1 checks out. The whole argument is really going to ride on premise number 2. Is the majority ruled by propagandists? Let's take a look at Bernays' argument. Quote, "Universal literacy was supposed to educate the common man to control his environment. Once he could read and write, he would have a mind fit to rule. So ran the democratic doctrine. But instead of a mind, universal literacy has given him rubber stamps. Rubber stamps inked with advertising slogans, with editorials, with published scientific data, with the trivialities of the tabloids and the platitudes of history, but quite innocent of original thought. Each man's rubber stamps are the duplicates of millions of others, so that when those millions are exposed to the same stimuli, all receive identical imprints. It may seem an exaggeration to say that the American public gets most of its ideas in this wholesale fashion. The mechanism by which ideas are disseminated on a large scale is propaganda, in the broad sense of an organized effort to spread a particular belief or doctrine. Unquote. So, in other words, the mere ability to read words, which is something nearly everybody in a first world country like America can do, is actually a great tool of the propagandist, despite the fact that universal literacy is always presented as a great liberatory feat. The fact is that mere reading doesn't magically imbue the reader with the know-how or even the inclination to criticize and question what he or she reads. The printed word becomes a ubiquitous vehicle for propaganda, and with signs and slogans plastered on every wall and hanging in every window, universal literacy has dropped us into a silent noisescape. Buy, sell, eat, fuck, laugh, hit, cry, come, go, remember, hope, and don't forget to vote, vote, vote.
Not important to get children to read. Children who want to read are going to read. Kids who want to learn to read are going to learn to read. Much more important to teach children to question what they read. Children should be taught to question everything. To question everything they read, everything they hear. Children should be taught to question authority. Parents never teach their children to question authority because parents are authority figures themselves and they don't want to undermine their own bullshit inside the household. So they stroke the kid and the kid strokes them and they all stroke each other and they all grow up all fucked up and they come to shows like this.
Yes, people can read, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they'll read critically. Just like how somebody who watches the news isn't necessarily informed, though they may well be in formation. So as evidence for the claim that the majority is ruled by propagandists, we have the fact that universal literacy, absent critical thought, is a universal vehicle for propaganda. To expand on how this works, Bernays cites a couple of newspaper articles and explains how they subtly manipulate the readership by taking advantage of people's inclination to accept what they read if it's coming from a perceived authority. One of the articles lists the State Department as its source. The second credits the Carnegie Foundation. Both of these institutions are generally trusted by Americans, thus offering them as sources naturally lends credibility to the stories. The two headlines are, 12 Nations Warn China Real Reform Must Come Before They Give Relief, and Pritchett Reports Zionism Will Fail. These headlines, Bernays says, quote, illustrate how conscious direction is given to events, and how the men behind these events influence public opinion, unquote. In other words, these stories are both presented with a particular slant, but the slant is made to seem like fair and balanced analysis by appealing to the authority of the sources. We don't have to be critical, because we already know these institutions are competent and honest. He expands even further on this by bringing up the example of World War I. If ever there were an example of propagandists really getting one over on the American public, sheesh. If, he says, quote, those whose position or ability can no longer do what they want without the approval of the masses, they find in propaganda a tool which is increasingly powerful in gaining that approval. Therefore, propaganda is here to stay. It was, of course, the astounding success of propaganda during the war that opened the eyes of the intelligent few in all departments of life to the possibilities of regimenting the public mind. The American government and numerous patriotic agencies developed a technique which, to most persons accustomed to bidding for public acceptance, was new. They not only appealed to the individual by means of every approach, visual, graphic, and auditory, to support the national endeavor, but they also secured the cooperation of the key men in every group, persons whose mere word carried authority to hundreds or thousands or hundreds of thousands of followers. They thus automatically gained the support of fraternal, religious, commercial, patriotic, social, and local groups whose members took their opinions from their accustomed leaders and spokesmen or from the periodical publications which they were accustomed to read and believe. At the same time, the manipulators of patriotic opinion made use of the mental clichés and the emotional habits of the public to produce mass reactions against the alleged atrocities, the terror, and the tyranny of the enemy. It was only natural, after the war ended, that intelligent persons should ask themselves whether it was not possible to apply a similar technique to the problems of peace. Unquote. God, I just want to keep reading because it gets even more interesting. But I'll stop for a minute. Yes, it's a bit strange that Bernays calls wartime propaganda successful when all it really succeeded in was fomenting international hatred and ensuring the miserable mass murders of some 18 million people. And yes, it's strange that Bernays equates this with intelligence. But the fact of the matter is that powerful people in the United States, particularly individuals in the government and in academia, wanted the U.S. to fight in the war. And they got their way thanks to a propaganda campaign of which Bernays was a part. I gotta say, the whole World War I thing is pretty damning evidence in support of the claim that the majority is ruled by propagandists. I mean, if you can convince people to fight in a war for totally bullshit reasons, if you can convince people to let their children go crouch in muddy ditches for months on end while airplanes shit fire down on them and strangers try to shoot them and rats try to eat them, what can't you convince people to do? And obviously this wasn't a novelty of Bernays's era. How about the first Gulf War? The whole they took the babies out of the incubators thing. Let me read you a bit from the preface of Larry Tye's biography of Bernays called The Father of Spin. Quote, "The selling of America on the Persian Gulf War was a public relations triumph. Its leading man, Saddam Hussein, was cast as pure villain, complete with menacing leer and malevolent mustache. It had Iraqi soldiers snatching infants from hospital incubators and leaving them on the floor to die while Iraqi helicopters hovered over Kuwait City and Iraqi tanks rolled down the streets. The Kuwaiti military, meanwhile, was portrayed as alive, well, and eager to fight back against the invaders. One detail was left out of that version of the war, however. The fact that it was crafted by one of America's biggest public relations firms, Hill and Knowlton, in a campaign bought and paid for by rich Kuwaitis who were Saddam's archenemies." Unquote. The whole thing was such a show that the young woman who delivered the sobbing "they took the babies out of the incubators" story to the UN, it turned out, was the daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador to the United States, and her testimony was organized by a subset of Hill and Knowlton. Do I need to remind you of the second Gulf War and the whole WMD fiasco? That was in my lifetime. Do I even dare bring up what's going on in America right now? I hate to say it, but as much as I dislike Bernays and as much as I detest his methods, I think he's dead on when it comes to democracy. If the majority rules, then whoever can influence the majority rules. And boy, is the majority influenceable. This really should have been clear after they executed Socrates, but what you gonna do? Of course, where I differ drastically from Bernays is that I don't particularly like this fact about democracy, whereas he's all for it. Democracy is his bread and butter. Without democracy, he might be out of a job. Now, I know there's gotta be someone out there who's saying, "But we're not a democracy. We're a democratic republic." Okay, fine. That's what the founders intended. But tell me, is there some magical element of a democratic republic which prevents it from ever becoming anything else? James Madison, the last surviving founding father, died in 1836. And in case you haven't noticed, it's a different fucking country now. And in case you haven't noticed, most people seem to call America and think of America as a democracy, regardless of what old conservatives and the Pledge of Allegiance say. And in case you haven't noticed, there's been a steady rhetorical and cultural push toward more democracy in America and around the world since when? Oh, yes, the Progressive Era, which was, funnily enough, just when Bernays and his ilk were getting started. Now listen, I'm with you. I know that the founders, generally speaking, did not like democracy. And I, like you, my small r Republican friend, agree with them. Maybe a democratic republic would be preferable to a democracy. But the reality of our situation is that for over 100 years, influential people, dare I say, propagandists, in politics and in schools and in colleges and in media have been feeding us this democratic line. And as Bernays reveals in his book, contrary to what the average person might think, given all they've been told or sold about democracy, democracy actually benefits those in power. I think Bernays has already made that pretty clear, and he'll certainly continue to do so as we dig deeper into his book. But let me illustrate it another way. A pretty good indicator of how much democracy there is would be what percentage of the total population votes, right? The highest voter turnout in the U.S. before 1920 was in 1896, when about 19.5% of the total population voted. Of course, 1920, the first year women could vote nationally, smashed this record with about 25% of the total population turning up to vote. Turnout continued to rise over the next five national elections, peaking at almost 38% in 1940, and then dropping to around 33-34% in 44 and in 48. But in 52, it was higher than ever, at 39.5%. I'm not going to read off every year. I think you get the picture. In 2016, 48% of the total population voted. Again, this isn't the eligible voting population. 48% of the total population voted. And of course, in 2020, even that record was beaten, as more Americans voted for a carnival barker or that other guy than for any other presidential candidates ever. So, we must ask, as more and more Americans have turned out to vote, has the country been involved in more or less foreign military conflicts? Has consolidation of media and retail and food corporations picked up or slowed down? Has confidence in our democratically elected institutions risen or fallen? Has the interplay between government and corporations increased or decreased? How about income inequality, which is something people who say they want more democracy love to talk about? Now, I know that correlation is not causation, so I can't say that higher voter turnout caused the uptick in wars and corporatism and whatnot, but I can say that 100 years of rising voter turnout failed to prevent these seemingly undemocratic trends from occurring. Given everything we've been told about democracy since we were too young to ask any real questions about it, doesn't this strike you as, a little odd? Fuck it, let's get another Carlin clip in here.
But there's a reason, there's a reason. There's a reason for this, there's a reason education sucks, and it's the same reason that it will never, ever, ever be fixed. It's never going to get any better. Don't look for it. Be happy with what you got. Because the owners of this country don't want that. I'm talking about the real owners now. The real owners, the big wealthy business interests that control things and make all the important decisions. Forget the politicians. The politicians are put there to give you the idea that you have freedom of choice. You don't. You have no choice. You have owners. They own you. They own everything. They own all the important land. They own and control the corporations. They've long since bought and paid for the Senate, the Congress, the state houses, the city halls. They got the judges in their back pockets. And they own all the big media companies, so they control just about all of the news and information you get to hear. They got you by the balls. They spend billions of dollars every year lobbying to get what they want. Well, we know what they want. They want more for themselves and less for everybody else. But I'll tell you what they don't want. They don't want a population of citizens capable of critical thinking. They don't want well-informed, well-educated people capable of critical thinking. They're not interested in that. That doesn't help them. That's against their interest. That's right. They don't want people who are smart enough to sit around the kitchen table and figure out how badly they're getting fucked by a system that threw them overboard 30 fucking years ago. They don't want that. You know what they want? They want obedient workers, people who are just smart enough to run the machines and do the paperwork and just dumb enough to passively accept all these increasingly shittier jobs with the lower pay, the longer hours, the reduced benefits, the end of overtime, and the vanishing pension that disappears the minute you go to collect it. And now they're coming for your Social Security money. They want your fucking retirement money. They want it back. so they can give it to their criminal friends on Wall Street. And you know something? They'll get it. They'll get it all from you sooner or later because they own this fucking place. It's a big club, and you ain't in it. You and I are not in the big club. By the way, it's the same big club they used to beat you over the head with all day long when they tell you what to believe. All day long, beating you over the head in their media, telling you what to believe, what to think, and what to buy. The table is tilted, folks. The game is rigged. And nobody seems to notice. Nobody seems to care. Good, honest, hardworking people, white collar, blue collar, doesn't matter what color shirt you have on. Good, honest, hardworking people continue. These are people of modest means. Continue to elect these rich cocksuckers who don't give a fuck about them. They don't give a fuck about you. They don't give a fuck about you. They don't care about you at all. At all. At all. Yeah. You know? And nobody seems to notice, nobody seems to care. That's what the owners count on, the fact that Americans will probably remain willfully ignorant of the big red, white, and blue dick that's being jammed up their assholes every day. Because the owners of this country know the truth. It's called the American dream, because you have to be asleep to believe it.
Joe Pesci blessed that man. Anyway, I want to get back to Bernays in the book Propaganda. But I just want to repeat my reading of his stance on democracy, because I think it's really, really important. And I wish more people would recognize how democracy is conducive to propaganda and those in power. So, once again, if the majority rules, then those who can influence the majority rule. Now let's take this further. Remember when Bernays was writing this? To us today, things like trains and airplanes are easy to take for granted, and things like telegraphs and newspapers are easy to forget as obsolete. But back in 1928, this stuff was the high-tech cutting edge, and Bernays rightly recognized that evolving technology plays a critical role in what he called the regimenting of the public mind. Bernays writes that, quote, "As civilization has become more complex, and as the need for invisible government has been increasingly demonstrated, the technical means have been invented and developed by which opinion may be regimented. With the printing press and the newspaper, the railroad, the telephone, telegraph, radio, and airplanes, ideas can be spread rapidly and even instantaneously over the whole of America." Unquote. He then quotes a New York Times article by H.G. Wells, in which Wells says that these technical advances will essentially serve to homogenize the American nation. Bernays summarizes Wells as follows, quote, "The groupings and affiliations of society today are no longer subject to local and sectional limitations. When the Constitution was adopted, the unit of organization was the village community, which produced the greater part of its own necessary commodities and generated its group ideas and opinions by personal contact and discussion directly among its citizens. But today, because ideas can be instantaneously transmitted to any distance and to any number of people, this geographical integration has been supplemented by many other kinds of grouping, so that persons having the same ideas and interests may be associated and regimented for common action even though they live thousands of miles apart." Unquote. Put simply, follow me on Twitter at Story of Nowhere. This technical interconnectivity leads Bernays to invoke an old medieval idea which had since been made over and modernized by earlier progressive intellectuals. I'm referring, of course, to the social organism, the idea of a body politic. The new propaganda, he writes, quote, "takes account not merely of the individual, nor even of the mass mind alone, but also and especially of the anatomy of society, with its interlocking group formations and loyalties. It sees the individual not only as a cell in the social organism, but as a cell organized into the social unit. Touch a nerve at a sensitive spot, and you get an automatic response from certain specific members of the organism." Unquote. This is a way of thinking about people not as people, but as little stereotypes of a group, avatars of a type. This is the beginning of targeted advertising and, dare I say, modern identity politics. Now, because people can be brought together technologically over vast differences, Bernays then explains that it's the propagandist's job to spin events, or completely manufacture events, for these interconnected populations to react to. And, of course, based on one's group affiliations, one will react in a predictable manner. Quote, "Modern propaganda is a consistent, enduring effort to create or shape events to influence the relations of the public to an enterprise, idea, or group. This practice of creating circumstances and of creating pictures in the minds of millions of persons is very common. Virtually no important undertaking is now carried on without it, whether that enterprise be building a cathedral, endowing a university, marketing a moving picture, floating a large bond issue, or electing a president. Sometimes the effect on the public is created by a professional propagandist, sometimes by an amateur deputed for the job. The important thing is that it is universal and continuous, and in its sum total, it is regimenting the public mind every bit as much as an army regiments the bodies of its soldiers." Unquote. Later on, in a chapter entitled The Psychology of Public Relations, Bernays describes how this sort of event creation might apply to marketing. We've already been over the story of the green ball, which is one example of this. Now he explains this tactic using the example of trying to sell a piano. Basically, his goal is as follows. Quote, "Under the old salesmanship, the manufacturer said to the prospective purchaser, 'Please buy a piano.' The new salesmanship has reversed the process and caused the prospective purchaser to say to the manufacturer, 'Please sell me a piano.'" Unquote. To accomplish this, Bernays explains that the propagandist must effectively change people's attitudes toward pianos. He suggests promoting a popular play in which a music room is a central feature. This would get well-to-do people thinking that music rooms are in, and what music room is complete without a piano? Of course, you might showcase the particular brand of piano you're selling by making sure it's the one featured in the play. No one needs to know that the whole thing is basically one big commercial. Just like nobody knew that the green ball was really just a big commercial for Lucky Strikes. Continuing this theme, he says that you could convince architects to plan for music rooms in the new homes they build. You could put on an exhibition featuring all the goddamn fashion people, and you could host it in one of their music rooms. The point of it all is to make what you're selling stylish. The thing. And then, best of all, when the average unknown fuck finally decides to buy your damn product, Bernays says, quote, "it will come to him as his own idea," unquote. Now, I personally am not too worried about piano salesmen. What I am worried about is how this tactic applies to political attitudes. Ask yourself if, particularly in mass media, if certain political attitudes and beliefs are generally presented as fashionable or cool or in or hip or whatever, and if other attitudes and beliefs are generally presented as unfashionable, uncool, out, or lame. If you notice this sort of thing going on, you just might be witnessing some Bernaysian propaganda in action. As a general rule, if somebody's trying to be cool, he's probably evil. So anyway, what Bernays is getting at here is that it's not good enough to appeal to people's rationality and say, "hey, buy a piano," because the rational response to a sales pitch might be, "hey, fuck off." You've really got to work the person, but you've got to work him without him knowing you're working him. You've got to get everyone and everything around him to tell him to do what you want him to do. You've got to get his circumstances to tell him what you want him to do. That way, when he finally does do what you want him to do, he'll think he's making a rational decision. Quote, "Men are rarely aware of the real reasons which motivate their actions. A man may believe that he buys a motor car because, after careful study of the technical features of all makes on the market, he has concluded that this is the best. He's almost certainly fooling himself. He bought it, perhaps, because a friend whose financial acumen he respects bought one last week, or because his neighbors believed he was not able to afford a car of that class, or because its colors are those of his college fraternity. It's chiefly the psychologists of the school of Freud who have pointed out that many of man's thoughts and actions are compensatory substitutes for desires which he has been obliged to suppress. A thing may be desired not for its intrinsic worth or usefulness, but because he has unconsciously come to see it as symbol of something else. the desire for which he is ashamed to admit to himself. A man buying a car may think he wants it for purposes of locomotion, whereas the fact may be that he would really prefer not to be burdened with it, and would rather walk for the sake of his health. He may really want it because it's a symbol of social position, an evidence of his success in business, or a means of pleasing his wife. Unquote. So, the propagandist creates the circumstances which get the man or woman to think he or she rationally wants something which, in fact, he or she rationally may not want. That's Bernays' claim, and that's the approach to propaganda that he took over his career, which lasted many decades. There's an important, albeit subtle, point in here that people often overlook. The use of the word create is, or can be, misleading. Bernays says the propagandist creates circumstances. The filmmaker Adam Curtis, who made a documentary about Bernays 15 or 20 years ago, took it further and said that Bernays created desires. I know what Adam Curtis means, but this is a problem. It's a problem because it gives the impression that Bernays and people like him can just invent human desires out of thin air because they're cartoon bad guys or something. As if women wouldn't have wanted to smoke if it weren't for Bernays. Or as if people wouldn't have bought the green packaged Lucky Strikes unless green was the in color. I mean, come on, what came first? The cigarette or the cigarette ad? What you need to appreciate is that while a Bernays might indeed create a circumstance, like the green ball or a play to popularize a piano, these circumstances don't create desires. They point to things which will supposedly fulfill desires that already exist. We just heard him say as much himself. Quote, "It is chiefly the psychologists of the school of Freud who have pointed out that many of man's thoughts and actions are compensatory substitutes for desires which he has been obliged to suppress. A thing may be desired not for its intrinsic worth or usefulness, but because he has unconsciously come to see it as a symbol of something else." Unquote. But I've heard some people, understandably, come away from Bernays thinking that he thought he was actually creating new human desires, which would be crazy, of course. Bernays himself probably contributed to this misinterpretation, as he was one of those types of dudes whose stories about himself got more and more about him as he got older, and as actual eyewitnesses to the real events died off. So he may have, at times, embellished his impact upon the public mind. After all, he did remark that, quote, "In an era of mass communication, modesty is a private virtue and a public fault," unquote. Despite all that, his techniques only worked because he played on impulses that already exist, like the desire to fit in and to feel safe and to seem intelligent. Writing decades later, Jacques Ellul said that this is actually a crucial element of all propaganda. He writes on page 33 of Propaganda, the Formation of Men's Attitudes, that propaganda, quote, "cannot be utilized to make an individual act in just any direction. The individual cannot be manipulated as if he were an object, an automaton. The automatic nature of created reflex does not transform him into a robot. We can conclude from a large body of experience that the propagandist cannot go contrary to what is in an individual. He cannot create just any new psychological mechanism or obtain just any decision or action." Unquote. Overlooking this simple and fundamental fact about propaganda leads to some pretty dire misinterpretations. On one level, if you don't appreciate this fact, you might get the impression that propagandists can just implant whatever they want into people's heads, which will give you a cartoonish and maybe even paranoid notion of propaganda. Take it to a deeper level, and you might assume the same thing, that propagandists simply want to implant you with new ideas and imagine that they really can, and then conclude that that's ridiculous, and that propaganda is inconsequential, and that only an idiot would ever fall for it. But that is a straw man critique of propaganda. Remember what Bernays said at the beginning of the book. It is they, the invisible governors, who pull the wires which control the public mind, who harness old social forces and contrive new ways to bind and guide the world. Harness old social forces. Contrive new ways. To contrive something new, you've got to work with what's already there. That is how propaganda works. This is what Bernays did with the green ball, and it's what he's talking about in the piano example. How do you sell cigarettes? You show people. You don't tell them. You show them that smoking is what the in-group does. How do you sell pianos? You show people that all the in-folks own pianos. And of course, smoking and music are, in fact, pleasurable. Feels good, and all the cool kids are doing it. Just keep pointing at that over and over, and a good number of people will do what you want. Because that's what people do. Follow. We're pack animals, and we've got to work. So when we come home, we want something to make us feel good. And we want to fit in. And more importantly, we want to feel like we're the ones setting the trend. Like we're the early adopters who are ahead of the curve. We don't want to feel like followers. We want to feel like leaders. All Bernays needed to do was harness these old social forces that date all the way back to our monkey days, forces of belonging, of status, of luxury, of celebration, and he could get people to buy smokes and pianos, all while thinking it was their own idea. Still, it must be said that Bernays might be overselling his craft a bit. That's my opinion, anyway. Remember that this book was written for his potential clientele. Sure, it's a propaganda manual, but it's also a propaganda ad. He wants to sell his services, and he is a salesman after all, so is it really so crazy to think he might be exaggerating a bit? Even though he does acknowledge that propaganda is based on forces that already exist, he does so seldomly and almost begrudgingly, as if he's determined to sell the erroneous and somewhat widespread belief that propagandists are in fact implanting totally new impulses into the minds of men and women. It almost seems as if he wants his readers to believe that the masses are more malleable than they actually are. It would certainly help his business if people thought this was the case. Now, obviously, that's not to say that it's all or even mostly exaggerated. If I thought this was the case, I wouldn't be doing a show on Bernays or his book in the first place. His techniques have worked and do work. All I'm saying is that he may be employing those techniques in this book in order to sell his services. The philosophy he pushes is one of extreme collectivism. The individual is completely and totally subject to the will of the group. And of course, the group will is in turn set by the propagandists, the invisible government. I would never deny that we're all embedded in groups, and that the groups we associate with affect our behavior substantially. We define ourselves according to our associations, and our attitudes are certainly affected by the company we keep and the ideas we share. There's no getting around that. We are a social animal. But I don't think that means we're completely locked in to whatever the groups around us are doing. But to the extent that we are locked in, the propagandist is there. In an earlier book called Crystallizing Public Opinion, Bernays wrote, quote, "It is his, that is the propagandist's, capacity for crystallizing the obscure tendencies of the public mind before they have reached definite expression, which makes him, the propagandist, so valuable." Unquote. It's kind of like, if you've ever read Watchmen, the graphic novel, how the character Ozymandias predicts the future by watching like 40 TVs all at once, just to subconsciously soak in all of the trends and attitudes circulating in the mass mind. That's what Bernays' propagandist does. And as we've already seen, Bernays thinks this sort of people who can read trends and make predictions about mass behavior should actually rule society. According to Bernays' biographer Larry Tye, quote, "His PR man was no Democrat. Bernays, like Lippmann and Laban, was wary of the common man, especially when he got together with other common men. The social theorists were all for doing good, but felt that it was best accomplished when socially enlightened leaders, drawn together in Bernays' case by the enlightened Public Relations Council, who would replace princes, priests, and other benevolent rulers of bygone days." Unquote. Though Bernays sought to replace what he perceived as obsolete forms of rulership, again, he recognized the need to harness and use old social forces to accomplish modern ends. For instance, while he himself didn't believe in God, he saw the idea of God as vital to social stability. Marvin Olansky, who interviewed Bernays on the subject, reports that Bernays, quote, "saw what he called in our interview, a world without God, rapidly descending into social chaos. Therefore, he contended that social manipulation by public relations counselors was justified by the end of creating man-made gods, who could assert subtle social control and prevent disaster. Pulling strings behind the scenes was necessary not only for personal advantage, but for social salvation. Unquote. This is a tremendous power Bernays confers on himself and his kind, but he assures us in Propaganda that this terrific job of nobly lying gods into existence will be reined in by a strict code of ethics. The PR man will turn down any dishonest client, we are told, and would never support any antisocial product or service. The propagandist, according to Bernays, doesn't exaggerate or bamboozle. The propagandist only leads people in subtle ways to the manufactured truths they ought to know. I've really been trying to give Bernays the benefit of the doubt in this show, guys, but I just can't do it here. I mean, this is just obvious bullshit. Does he really expect us to believe that the super powerful invisible governors are just going to be good all because he says they should be? This is a straight-up utopian vision he's peddling, in which benevolent and all-powerful geniuses imperceptibly guide the masses along the preset railway of progress by employing noble lies like God and choice and democracy. And of course, Bernays' own practice raises some serious questions about his propagandist's ethics that we're supposed to just accept. Obviously, for me, any involvement in selling World War I to the public is a bought-and-paid-for scuba trip to the Lake of Fire. But maybe you'll say he was young, or that maybe he just didn't know the justifications for the war were all bullshit or whatever. Fine. But were all of these excuses, were any of these excuses present when he basically directed the propaganda for a violent coup in Guatemala? Also, his corporate buddies could keep selling fucking bananas? Does that sound, oh, I don't know, a little antisocial? Even the smoking thing turned out to be sketchy. I was willing to give him the benefit of the doubt on that one. I mean, it was the 20s and 30s. People didn't know it was bad for you, right? Personally, don't understand how someone would need a science experiment to tell them that breathing in hot smoke might not be healthy, but hey, okay. But it turns out that Bernays did know that cigarettes, at least, might be unhealthy. As detailed by biographer Larry Tye, who I've already cited, Bernays had read and kept up with medical reports concerning the risks of tobacco, all while he was working with American Tobacco Company. And, to put a nice little bow on all of that, he absolutely hated the fact that his wife smoked cigarettes for a few years. And according to his daughter Doris, quote, "He used to hide my mother's cigarettes and make us hide the cigarettes. He didn't think they were good for mother." Unquote. So I'm really not buying his ethical propaganda bullshit. And judging by his actions, it kind of looks like he didn't buy into it either. Sure, he probably had some wormy way of justifying what he got up to as virtuous and for the greater good and all that happy horse shit, but if you've got any real standards at all, you gotta see that what he was actually doing led to actual people actually being harmed directly as a result of his application of his precious public relations. His whole game was fooling people by manipulating their emotions and by taking advantage of their trust in authorities. And worst of all, he left a blueprint behind for others to do the same. The only upside to all of this is that we, the fools, now have access to that blueprint too. So read the damn thing! Here, listen to the table of contents. Chapter 1, Organizing Chaos. Chapter 2, The New Propaganda. Chapter 3, The New Propagandists. Chapter 4, The Psychology of Public Relations. Chapter 5, Business and the Public. Chapter 6, Propaganda and Political Leadership. Chapter 7, Women's Activities and Propaganda. Chapter 8, Propaganda for Education. Chapter 9, Propaganda in Social Service. Chapter 10, Art and Science. And Chapter 11, The Mechanics of Propaganda. Come on, how interesting does that sound? And it's free. Just check the show notes. I put it in there for you. And it's short. And yet there's still so much more to say about it. Hell, I didn't even tell you about how he says that presidential candidates are chosen by half a dozen men in a hotel room. Guess you're just gonna have to read it. So in conclusion, I'm not going to tell you what you should take away from this, because I'm not your kindergarten teacher, and because I do actually want you to read the book yourself. But I will tell you some of the ideas that really stand out to me from this book. First, just the brazen admission that everything you see and think is carefully crafted malarkey. An admission made by a guy who worked for decades with big corporations as well as the U.S. government, who just so happened to be a nephew of Sigmund Freud. I think that ignoring that or brushing it off, I mean, that'd be pretty dang naive. Second, I love his analysis of democracy. Although the fact that he remains pro-democracy following this analysis is somewhat disturbing. Honestly, the fact that he favors democracy was probably what forever turned me against democracy. But still, spot-on analysis. If the majority rules, then those who can influence the majority rule. Third, actually, this is probably a continuation of what I just said, but screw it, it deserves its own point. Third, he says that propaganda is necessary in American society because the average person doesn't have the time or energy or intelligence to sort through all of the information out there. So the people consent to have an invisible government that they're unaware of present them with information that's deemed palatable. So even if we imagine that people do have some degree of free choice, which I believe they do, hell, even if we imagine that people have some degree of rationality, the secretive class of learned experts still provide the frame. We may be able to pick between option A and option B, but they're the ones who choose to leave off options C and D, you see. But don't worry, it's all so our society can continue to run smoothly and continue to progress. Fourth, is it gratuitous to have a fourth? Fourth, there's the bit about how propaganda doesn't actually create new impulses, but rather harnesses old ones. That is very important to appreciate. And it's definitely gratuitous to have a fifth point. This is a book I come back to often, and every time I do, I come away just a little bit sharper, just a little more aware of all the strings and wires flicking and twitching behind everything. I mean it. If you really sit with this 90-some-year-old fuck-with-people manual and pick apart what he says and take note of all the little techniques, you will begin to spot his propaganda everywhere. Well, it's time for me to pull my cord. But fear not. This will not be the last we hear of Edward L. Bernays, father of public relations, cousin of psychoanalysis, nor will it be the last we hear of his opus, Propaganda. Not by a long shot. They will most certainly be back as we continue to tell the story of Nowhere, Tales from Utopia, where, of course, propaganda is the native tongue. Until next time, keep your eyes open and get a copy of this book. If you're one who's always worried about business or advertising or politics, then you should probably give it a good cover-to-cover reading, because if you do, you won't have to worry anymore. You'll know.
This is called advertising lullaby. Keeping in mind, of course, that the whole purpose of advertising is to lull you to sleep. Quality, value, style, service, selection, convenience, economy, savings, performance, experience, hospitality, low rates, friendly service, name brands, easy terms, affordable prices, money-back guarantee, free installation. Free admission, free appraisal, free alterations, free delivery, free estimates, free home trial, and free parking. No cash, no problem, no kidding. No fuss, no muss, no risk, no obligation, no red tape, no down payment, no entry fee, no hidden charges, no purchase necessary, no one will call on you, no payments or interest till September. But limited time only, though, so act now, order today, send no money, offer good while supplies last, two to a customer, each item sold separately, batteries not included, mileage may vary, all sales are final, allow 6 weeks for delivery, some items not available, some assembly required, some restrictions may apply. So come on in. Come on in. Come on in for a free demonstration and a free consultation with our friendly professional staff. Our experienced and knowledgeable sales representatives will help you make a selection that's just right for you and just right for your budget. And say, don't forget to pick up your free gift, a classic deluxe custom designer luxury prestige high quality premium select gourmet pocket pencil sharpener. Yours for the asking, no purchase necessary. It's our way of saying thank you. And if you act now, we'll include an extra added free complimentary bonus gift, a classic deluxe custom designer luxury prestige high quality premium select gourmet combination key ring, magnifying glass, and garden hose in a genuine imitation leather style carrying case with authentic vinyl trim. Yours for the asking, no purchase necessary. It's our way of saying thank you. Actually, it's our way of saying bend over just a little bit farther so we can stick this big advertising dick up your ass a little bit deeper. A little bit deeper. A little bit deeper. You miserable, no good fucking consumer asshole. Because you do know, folks, living in this country, you're bound to know that every time you're exposed to advertising, you realize once again that America's leading industry, America's most profitable business, is still the manufacture, packaging, distribution, and marketing of bullshit. High quality, grade A, prime cut, pure American bullshit. And the sad part is that most people seem to have been indoctrinated to believe that bullshit only comes from certain places, certain sources. Advertising, politics, salesmen, not true. Bullshit is everywhere. Bullshit is rampant. Parents are full of shit, teachers are full of shit, clergymen are full of shit, and law enforcement people are full of shit. This entire country is completely full of shit. And always has been, from the Declaration of Independence to the Constitution to the Star-Spangled Banner, it's still nothing more than one big steaming pile of red, white, and blue, all-American bullshit. Because think of how we started. Think of that. This country was founded by a group of slave owners who told us all men are created equal. Oh, yeah, all men, except for Indians and niggers and women, right? Always like to use that authentic American language. This was a small group of unelected white male landholding slave owners who also suggested their class be the only one allowed to vote. Now that is what's known as being stunningly and embarrassingly full of shit. And I think Americans really show their ignorance when they say they want their politicians to be honest. What are these fucking cretins talking about? If honesty were suddenly introduced into American life, the whole system would collapse. No one would know what to do. Honesty would fuck this country up. And I think deep down, Americans know that. That's why they elected and reelected Bill Clinton. That's why. Because the American people like their bullshit right out front where they can get a good, strong whiff of it. Clinton might be full of shit, but at least he lets you know it. Dole tried to hide it, didn't he? Dole kept saying, I'm a plain and honest man. Bullshit. People don't believe that. What did Clinton say? He said, hi, folks, I'm completely full of shit, and how do you like that? And the people said, you know something? At least he's honest. At least he's honest about being completely full of shit. It's just like the business world, same as business. Everybody knows by now, all businessmen are completely full of shit. Just the worst kind of low-life criminal cocksuckers you could ever want to run into. A fucking piece of shit businessman. And the proof of it is, they don't even trust each other. They don't trust one another. When a businessman sits down to negotiate a deal, the first thing he does is to automatically assume that the other guy is a complete lying prick who's trying to fuck him out of his money. So he's got to do everything he can to fuck the other guy a little bit faster and a little bit harder. And he's got to do it with a big smile on his face. You know that big bullshit businessman smile? And if you're a customer, whoa! That's when you get the really big smile. Customer always gets that really big smile as the businessman carefully positions himself directly behind the customer and unzips his pants and proceeds to service the account. I'm servicing this account. This customer needs service. Now you know what they mean. Now you know what they mean when they say, we specialize in customer service. Whoever coined the phrase, let the buyer beware, was probably bleeding from the asshole. But that's business. That's business.